Gary Pippin, and here we are, of course, in Eureka Springs, Arkansas again. Wendell Stevens, always good to see you. We've done a lot of shows from Eureka Springs.
Yes, you sure have.
You didn't have any trouble getting here, huh?
No, I didn't have any trouble. I had a Continental Airlines ticket. American passengers did have trouble, though.
Well, you're an old pilot, and I mean that respectfully. I didn't quite understand that wire.
I couldn't see where there was a real safety hazard, because the problem was the spacing on the straps that hold the bundles of wire together should have been 4 inches apart, and it was 6 inches apart. So they clipped them all off and put 4-inch binds on, banding on all of those bundles of wire. That was the safety problem.
So looks like somebody was exerting their power here. I guess we'll leave it at that. You talked about Billy Meyer again here.
Yes.
Anything new there? I know Mike Horn has a new DVD out about it.
Yes, he does. It's a nice DVD. It's well done. It's got a lot of images of Billy Meyer when he was a younger man that I never had before.
Now, you when you met him, how old was he?
Well, I think he looked like he was in his middle 30s when I first met him. Yes, and he's up in his middle 60s now.
And so, and how many times have you been over there?
I went over there 11 times, and I spent...
Yeah, I knew it was a lot.
Yeah. All at my expense, my own money, too. And I stayed anywhere from a week to 2 weeks each time in his household, living in a room upstairs, right with his family, watching everything going on. I worked with him, hauling manure for their gardens and picking rocks out of the gardens and helping them grade the road and things like that to be useful while I was there.
Well, you know, we have a couple of interviews with you on our website that people can find and listen to, in which you talked in great detail about some of your experiences with Billy Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought if it'd be okay with you, we might talk to you about a few of these other things happening. What else has piqued your interest these days?
Well,
you're always writing, and as you explained to me one time, it's not exactly like a book, but it is a book. It's more like an Air Force report.
It's a report, like a journalistic report, or like a military report. Uh-huh. I'm used to writing military reports, and I write like that, just like a journalistic report of events as they happen. I'm not a writer. I don't write with an introduction, a build-up, a climax, and a close. That's how books are written. I write the events as they happen, with all the data in the event. It's like a journalistic, like you read in a newspaper. The surprises come wherever they happen during the investigation.
What have you been investigating recently? Yeah, you've been doing a lot of traveling, making appearances at conferences. Maybe you haven't had time to investigate anything.
Well, I haven't had much time to do a lot of investigating. I went to Argentina at their invitation just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really?
And they had a conference scheduled at Rosario, which is about 80 kilometers from Buenos Aires. When we got to Buenos Aires, though, we found that the produce trucks, huge produce trucks, were blocking all the roads out of the city because the new woman president had increased the tariff, the tax, on produce 50%. And the truckers weren't going to accept it, and in protest, they used their big trucks and blocked all the roads so nobody could get in or out of Buenos Aires. Until she went on the radio and agreed to moderate it a bit, she cut the 50% down to 25%. They moved the trucks that night, but the next morning they're back again. They had another meeting and decided that wasn't enough. So we never did get out of Buenos Aires. So what we did is went down to Pedro Romniak's house. Pedro Romniak is the Heineken of South America.
Uh-huh.
We went out to his little house on the outskirts of Buenos Aires, where we had a mini meeting of about 50 or 60 people that he got together on quick notice and did a presentation anyway. You know, I have been wanting to meet Pedro Romniak all my life. He was one of the prime contactees of the Umites when they were coming into Spain. They would contact the Spanish scientists by letter, using a public stenographer to write their letters, and they put the seal on it, and the stenographer would mail it. So they wrote a letter to Pedro Romniak in Argentina, but in the letter to Pedro Romniak, they sent a photograph of their ship, an Umite photograph. The Umite pictures are different from our technology. Their flat two-dimensional picture is perfect three-dimensional. The emulsion is made up of little disks of reflective material that scattered all through the emulsion in such a way that when you look at the picture, you can move your head and look behind.
You hold a snapshot and you move it around.
Has depth, like looking in a box.
Wow.
And I wanted to see that, and his room is house is like mine. He's got stuff piled everywhere. We couldn't find it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. I'd love to have seen it.
But they literally wrote him a letter, huh?
They wrote him several letters. With you might seal on, he had the originals. He sent me a copy of one of the originals way back when he was having these contacts.
And where does that stand at this date?
The Umites are still in contact with Spanish scientists. They have not. They have 18 other missions around the world, and we don't hear anything of the other missions. They're in strange countries like Zimbabwe and Bolivia, Argentina, Australia, outback.
I wonder why they chose those third world countries for.
Well, they had a base in Germany and Denmark and Yugoslavia, England also, mm-hmm. and it was two in the United States. So they are in first world countries. But when they discovered us way back in 1949, they became so interested in Earth phenomena because of the extreme variety we have in all species and types and classes of all living things. And they say that this peculiar variety comes from a particularly harsh sun and a reduced attenuation. When the flood came down, it cleared the skies. We saw it for the first time. It also allowed sharper radiation to come through from the sun. And it caused all lifespans to be decreased to 10%. Remember, all Earth lifespans before Moses were 1,000 years.
In the Bible.
And after the flood,
Methuselah.
He lived 1,009 years. Uh-huh. After the flood, all lifespans of all things on the planet were reduced to 10%. So we have short lifespans, a harsh sun causing rapid mutation, and we become the laboratory rats for all the other species. They come here to view mutation in progress.
Any chance that our lifespan is going to extend back to what it was, or is the sun just too powerful?
It's too powerful. If we could figure a way to do the shielding, like building domes over the whole cities, then we might be able to increase the lifespans of the people who live under the domes. I don't see any progress in that direction.
When we talk about Brazil, I know you've been down there several times. Mm-hmm. You don't speak Portuguese, do you?
No, but I translate it.
Do you? How do you do that?
I can read it, but I can't pronounce it.
Understand.
It's Spanish with a kind of a French accent on it that's hard for my tongue.
But you can read it?
I read it, yes.
Yeah. How many times have you been to Brazil? Five or six?
Maybe a dozen or more.
Oh, more than that, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I know we've talked about some pretty interesting things that have happened in Brazil over the years in our programs. Brazil seems to be an interesting place for UFO ET contact. Why?
Well, probably because of the size of it. Brazil is bigger than the whole United States, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has the dense jungles that were very remote and difficult to get to. So there was a lot of Brazil that remained unexplored for a long time. And are you familiar with the Adrien case in Miami, Florida?
No, tell me about that.
He was being contacted by what he said were Pleiadian humans that took him to an underground base in the southwest highlands of Brazil where those alien extraterrestrials were working in harmony with two other different race types in their underground facility. And he was taking
race types from other worlds,
three different worlds, mm-hmm. working in harmony in an underground
base.
What
were the other two race types? Sure.
Well, one was a gray species, and the other one was another human species.
Okay.
And they were getting along very well, and they had ships from all three of the societies in the underground hangars there. And way back in the 30s, a German explorer by the name of Brugger discovered the aliens there. He was exploring in the region, studying the wild natives that lived there, and somebody mentioned that there was Americans upstream. And it took him up to meet the Americans. They turned out to be the extraterrestrial humans. And they were, at that time, they were worried about the destruction of the forests in Brazil and encroaching civilization on their society, and I'm afraid they would be discovered and driven out. And they asked this German explorer if he could do anything for them, and when he got home after that to Germany, he told Germans that he wrote a book about his trip in Brazil, and word got to Goering, and he had told the aliens in Brazil that he would see what he could do about getting them some help to stop the encroachment of civilization on their area. So he told Goering about it, and Goering sent 2,000 German soldiers up into that area of Brazil. He sent them to the east coast of Brazil in submarines. They went by submarine ashore on rubber dinghies, and then hired taxis and things to get to a river port, and bought steamer tickets up the river as far as they could go, where the native tribes would take over and forward them right into where the aliens were. So the 2,000 German soldiers got to the alien facility, where they set up a defense perimeter inside of the aboriginals. And they married Indian women. They were all single German soldiers. They married Indian women, raised families, and the offspring of those families grew up going to school, the local schools run by the alien visitors. So they grew up being educated in alien technology. And the young German pilots now in their low 20s, by the time Adrien was taken down there, they were young pilots, German pilots from those families, had been raised in their schools, were working with those extraterrestrials and flying their vehicles. So Adrien...
You're talking about flying the ET?
They were flying the ET discs, yeah. Flying discs. Mm-hmm. And the Germans had even built the versions of the flying discs themselves, so they had German versions that were being flown by German pilots, and German pilots flying some of the alien extraterrestrial vehicles. And when Adrien and his living girlfriend were taken down there, they're still using a little plastic Polaroid camera. She took pictures of Adrien with his back to the camera, and one of the German pilots standing beside him watching three craft landing on little platforms, landing platforms down there in the jungle area. And I tried to get copies of those pictures. I was never allowed to possess it.
Was this after World War II or before?
It was after World War II.
After World War II. I know we talked about the Nazi influence in the ETs one time, you and mm-hmm. I did. And
yeah.
You said you ran across some pretty interesting papers in Wright-Patterson. It was Patterson Field back then.
Had them shredded and burned because I didn't know what they were. And later I found out that one of them was a map of the 9 Kugelblitz bases in the greater Germany that was very important to UFO research, but I didn't know it at the time because it was not in the need-to-know loop. And I shredded them or burned them.
So you think the German government today officially knows a lot about ETs?
No. The German government...
did that happen? That they don't know now.
When the Germans were helped to build the flying discs way back during the war, the alien visitors that helped them had another motive. They thought that the reason humanity was so belligerent was because they weren't familiar enough with each other. Only the rich could travel by steamer or by airliner. And they thought if we could mix better, we could become more acquainted with each other, more familiar with each other, we would lose some of our belligerence. So seeing, they were looking... They thought if they could give us an air transport that could be used very economically, it didn't require fuel, didn't require a big infrastructure out of town and everything like that, that everybody could travel freely because costing practically nothing to do so. So they began helping the German engineers. There was a surplus of German engineers after World War I when we bombed out and destroyed their factories. Then they went in and built new factories with aid programs and new material supply lines. So now we had new factories, new lines, new production facilities, and a lot of surplus German engineers. So the Aldebaran visitors concluded this would be the ideal place to build the airliners of the future. And they actually started and got operational discs. And when they saw the Germans invert a tank turret on the bottom of one and fire it, they realized that they may be giving us a bigger and better weapon. They sabotaged the whole program and left.
So in other words, it's not a new story. It's an old story through time. Somebody tries to help somebody else, and somebody figures out how to weaponize it.
Yeah, yeah. So the German engineers, in a couple of years, they were able to work around the sabotage efforts and get the program going again. They actually built flying discs before the war ended. They had the first ones under test by 1941. By 1940, I think it was 44 when we began our carpet bombing of the Schweinfurt bearing plant and the Plasti oil fields. And we had a 800 bomber mission on one night going into Germany. I think that was to the Plasti oil fields. 800 bombers. That's a lot of bombers.
Yes, it is.
And that night, the Germans had 9 Hanabus operational. They only used 6 of them. They launched them that night against the carpet bombing fleet, and they brought down 1/4 of the fleet, 200 bombers in one night, and over 3,000 crewmen.
And you're talking about 4 or 6?
Only 6 Hanabus. Okay. And the Hanabus only had 2 weapons aboard.
Kind of weapons were these?
One of them was called a Motorstoffel. It was nothing more than a beam, an electromagnetic beam that interrupted ignition circuits, caused engines to fail. That was one weapon. The other weapon was nothing but aerosol cans filled with benzene. It was dropped ahead of the bomber fleet with the spray valve open, creating a cloud of vapor. When the bomber fleet flew into the cloud of vapor, they'd get a big explosion, would take out a dozen bombers at a time. And on the other hand, when they caused the ignitions to fail, they were flying in such close formation to get gun coverage all around the fleet that if an engine began to misfire and fail, it would back into the one behind it. And that would cause him to back into another, if he turned away, he'd get the ones on the side.
As they flew in tight formations.
Yeah, so we lost 200 airplanes in one night. That's 1/4 of the fleet. We couldn't have continued the war at that rate. But
when you were in the Air Force, did you have an occasion to see any of those reports, what our version of that was? I wonder what we thought.
At that time, no. Yeah. No, I was not. I was out in the Pacific. Yeah, I was a fighter pilot in the Pacific.
I understand that. And you told me, I think, one time you really never really saw a UFO you were flying in a private plane up towards Chicago someplace.
Yeah, right. I never saw a Foo Fighter or anything like that. I heard about them, but I never saw it.
Mm-hmm. So, but you have no doubt this probably happened with the Nazis.
I'm convinced that it happened, that it did happen, and they succeeded in getting operational. Initially, what baffles me is after that success, which was turning the tide of war, all of the Hanabus were ordered out of Germany. Within 10 days, they were gone and never returned, never came back. And then Germany collapsed, and the Germans
Germany at that point lost their ET support.
Well, either that or somebody else ordered the Hanabus out and wouldn't let them. Somebody else is controlling the progress of wars, and the winner is already calculated. They knew who the winner is going to be, and that was changing the course of war, and they weren't going to allow it, whoever that is.
So are we talking about somebody else, like a new world order?
Bigger than governments. Bigger than national governments that ordered the Hanabus out of Germany to stop the changing of the progress of the war.
Have you done any, you've written, 80-some-odd books?
No, 31.
31?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're 85, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I got that part right.
Yeah.
30, well, that's still a lot of books. Reading that at all. Have you ever done anything about the New World Order and maybe the influence?
No, I haven't. I.
What do you think of that?
Well,
I mean, we've never discussed this.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree that we need a one-world government, that we're never going to enter the community of space travelers until we get a one-world government. Mm-hmm. Because as the situation stands now, if the aliens approach the American government, the Chinese and Russians wouldn't accept it. If they approach the Russians, the Chinese and Americans wouldn't. If they approach the Chinese and Russians, the Americans would not accept it. So we're not going to let anybody become the dominant power and control the world at the present stage of affairs. And we have to get to a point where we do have somebody speaking for this planet. And then we can begin interplanetary commerce, which has never begun for us.
But you think it's out there?
I think it's there, waiting. I think we have to get to a one-world government in order to join the community of planets that are waiting and available.
So instead of T-shirts from China. We might have them from Alpha Centauri.
Yeah.
Interesting thought. We're talking with Wendell Stevens. I'm Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back.
Why visit the Grand Canyon in Arizona? Marv Mason knows why.
Mainly because the Grand Canyon is known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world.
No one gives a more personalized tour or knows more about the Grand Canyon than Marvelous Marv.
My main thing is education on the geology, because the Grand Canyon is a life record. It shows us where we were at one time on the planet with the continental drift and all the layers that were laid down by sediments, and then how the canyon was carved. And of course, the views, you know, picture doesn't do it justice. But it's nice to have somebody there tell you about it that's lived there.
It's the best way to tour the Grand Canyon. Mar picks you up in a modern van at your hotel in the Grand Canyon area and takes you on a day-long tour. Contact Marvelous Mar Vacation Tours. Call and talk to him personally. 928-707-0291. Or visit his website.
MarvelousMarv.com. Real easy, real easy.
It's Jerry Pippin, and we are at the end of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs, of course, at the Ozark UFO Conference. Wendell Stevens. Really, Wendell, I think I'd call you the dean of UFO researchers. There's other people like Bob Dean, and other people have been around, but 31 books, and you've been doing this now, what, 40 years, 50 years?
Yeah. Since 1947.
Well, we can add that up real fast.
60 years.
That's 61 years.
Yeah.
So anyway, who are you?
My name is John Smith.
And where are you from, John?
Timbuktu.
I don't know if he's really telling us the truth or not. Go ahead, John. You have a question for Wendell.
I came in a little late, so that you might have already covered this. But what were the name of the things that you said were withdrawn from Nazi Germany?
Hanabus. They called them Hanabus.
Hanabus. What are those? Were those?
They're a flying disc about 100 feet in diameter.
Okay.
That worked under free energy. They didn't require any fuel to fly. They had gravity control and could rise and descend vertically. They could hover in the air. They had a degree of invisibility when they were under power and the force field was produced around them.
Okay, this sounds similar to the fellow who was on Coast the other night. I think his book is The Brotherhood of the Bell. Are you familiar with
something like that? Yeah.
What is his name? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
He's going to start working with Richard Hoagland. Their work has dovetailed, and they're going to start working together. But he's done research along these lines also.
So in other words, they had flying discs, the Nazis did.
Yes.
But these are different than that.
We may be talking about the same thing. The Nazi flying discs were bell-shaped. They were almost identical to the Adamski-type spacecraft.
The ones in the 50s, right.
Yeah.
And anyway, John, you got anything else?
I believe that'll do for now.
Okay. Thanks a lot for coming by. Wendell, when we talk about the Nazis and the New World Order, and then you're talking about really there's nobody on this planet that can speak for the planet, how do you envision this ever changing? We're pretty tribal, I guess.
I think it's very grim the way the situation lays right now. We're in a conflict we can't seem to get out of. I see our political situation deteriorating, personally. I am afraid that it may deteriorate to something that's even worse that we can't get out of. And I'm very afraid for where our society is.
Well,
going.
You one time told me, and I've forgotten how many species you thought there were around galaxies and interstellar space, but it was quite a few.
Yes. I think the variety of visitors is another example of the infinity of creation. There are no two exactly alike. And I get to this conclusion because of about 115 cases I've looked in great detail, studied them for years. And only two of those might have been coming from the same place, and that was Reticulum, but they came from different planets than one of the sun systems there, and they were not exactly the same species.
I had a fellow on in Laughlin who insists that he's been able to witness with special night vision goggles Star Wars-type activity going on. Have you run across, is there any battles going on out of there, or are they all enlightened at this point?
You know, I don't I don't know of any battles that are going on out there, but I am convinced in my own mind that we have scores of Earth-made flying discs made in the United States that can take off from their underground bases, go into orbit, and stay as long as their food supplies last, and come back under their own power and land at their underground bases again.
So in other words, you don't find it stretching the imagination at all when we talk about a secret space force going on right now.
No, I think we have squadrons.
You're an old Air Force guy. How do you keep that quiet? If I went to space and went around to a base on the moon or Mars or someplace, I'd have to tell somebody. I guess that's the reason I'm not doing it.
They tell me that there is a special academy out in the Colorado Springs area that when all of the plebes for the Air Force Academy arrive, they're screened for new plebes that have short family connections. They are either foster children, orphans.
And we talked about that with the Serpo story. These 12 that they chose, or 10, or ever how many there were, that they didn't have families.
Well, that's true. But people that work in the space program, flying discs, are chosen the same way, so they have no family, tight family connections. And when they accept a commission into that society, they don't change jobs like other officers do. They stay in the same job for the whole career, and when they retire, they just take off their uniform and go back to work in civilian clothes. Can't leave. They can only leave those facilities together or with others, like watching each other. And the perks are such that they're paid so well, and they have the best of all available.
So they have some sort of additional pro-pay bonus system where it's worthwhile.
They have the best food, the best entertainment, the best everything in their underground facilities. There's nothing better that they can get when they get out of there. They're paid well, and they have nice bank accounts and everything. If they defect, they lose their perks, and they probably are not going to live very long. And so they all know this. They're not going to break the rules.
And we talked in Laughlin, a harrowing story about a couple of people getting knocked off investigating things. So you have no doubt that it's a pretty dangerous job if you go investigate a UFO or start talking about it.
Yes, and I had one of our...
I'm talking about up in New Mexico. Remember that Holloman...
I had a Marine sentry from level 2 of S4 come to me one time. He told me that after his quarterly annual physical examination, they called him in a couple of days later and told him that he was dying of a fatal disease, and they were going to discharge him from the service and send him home so he could straighten out his affairs before he perished. They told him he had less than 2 weeks to live. Well, he knew if he had a disease, he's living internally on level 2 of S4 that's perfectly sanitary, not exposed to anything, that if he has a fatal disease, they have given it to him, his superiors, because he is... was also, all of the sentries there were used as government assassins. They don't call them assassinations, they call them missions. But those special forces troops like that are recruited at a very young age, on 17 or 18, where they're very impressionable. And they go through training exercises that make them weep when the flag goes up and down the flagpole. They're so patriotic. And they're prepared. They told and reminded all along that they're... job, there's an elite force, their job is to take care of the enemies of the American government. So they learn to believe their superiors implicitly. If anybody is characterized as an enemy of the American government and it's their job to take him out, they don't hesitate. Even if it would be their mother or a brother, they wouldn't hesitate. So that's that kind of training they had. Now, they call those operations special operations. They get $5,000 each for one. And they don't consider it murder. I consider an execution like that a murder. And this guy had done 18 of them. And I told him, don't you think you might be getting vulnerable about now? You know too much about everything. You're becoming a liability, not an asset anymore. And he says, yes, I think that's what's happened. He says, I think they have come to that conclusion too, and they have given me this disease. I said, well, let's go to a doctor and get it checked to see what we can do about it. He says, I don't want to know about it. If I'm going to go, I don't want to be waiting to die. He says, I don't want to know, but I'm going to bring their house of cards down if I can before I go. And he started giving me information on what was happening at level 2 of S4.
And do you know what happened to him? Did he die?
They finally killed him, yes.
Did he die right away? Or?
He didn't die right away. He lived for another month or so before I lost track of him.
And what kind of stuff did he tell you?
Well, he was going to take a shower, and he took the stuff out of his pockets and put it on my coffee table in my living room. Then he went in to take a shower, and I knew he was going to be in there for 5 minutes or more. So he laid his wallet on the table. He'd been giving me a name, that his name was Connor O'Ryan. So I thought, let's look in there and see what his name is. And I looked in his wallet, and his name was not Connor O'Ryan. Mm-hmm. That was a false name he was using. His real name was Derek Hennessy. And he told me that he had good business cards, good credit cards. And he had Diners Club, and he had American Express, and all the good cards. And he told me that he had $300,000 in the bank, but he couldn't draw any out after he left. His accounts were all frozen. And he feared the worst. So I also found, folded up tight in between the cards, was a W-4. You know what that is? That's a withholding statement.
Right.
A W-4 from his employer, the Central Intelligence Agency at Langley Field. He had a Central Intelligence number. He had a Central Intelligence code name. He was drawing $72,000 a year from Central Intelligence in addition to his Marine pay. And so I know that we have people like that. And he had there was also a copy of his last hit in there, and it was an American Green Beret, Army Green Beret in Budapest, Hungary. He left his level 2 position in S4 out in Nevada there, took an airline down to Los Angeles, all tickets provided by the government, another ticket to take him to Budapest. He was met at Budapest by the American Embassy staff car, picked up at the airport and driven to the American Embassy, where they took his American clothes away and gave him Hungarian clothes, Hungarian shoes, Hungarian pistol with Hungarian bullets in it, a key to an apartment rented in a Hungarian name, and told him that he was being paired with another special force troop to carry out this hit. They had something like 4 days to carry out the hit and leave. And there was also, he was given a picture profiled in the side view of the hit, where he lived, the routes he took to and from church to his grocery store, to his work and back, and where the kids went to school. And together they shot him to death coming out of a grocery store in front of his teenage kids in the car.
And then they caught the airplane and went home.
And yeah, they just disappeared and just blended with the crowd, walked back to the American Embassy. Why, they took up their pistol and clothes.
You know who this fellow was that they knocked off? I mean, was he an important person?
I don't know. He was an American Senior Master Sergeant Green Beret, Army Green Beret. So he told me that he had carried out a special mission just a few weeks before that. And I said, don't you think that's making you vulnerable? He said, I think so. He said, I know that I have eliminated a few others that I had doubts about, but my superiors had the information. They characterized him to me. They know. And so I believe that he would accept whatever his superiors told him as gospel fact. He would carry out the hit with no remorse. He doesn't feel bad about it. He's eliminating an enemy of the American government, which he's trained to do. And they don't call them assassinations at all. I think it's strictly government assassination. I shouldn't be doing this on your radio.
Ask you what I thought about the secret government. That story is even more revealing. They got a lot of people doing a lot of dirty things, huh?
Well, we shouldn't be talking about that on the radio.
Wendell, thanks very much for coming by. Our time's up on this thing. You're going to just keep on going, right?
Maybe not after this.
Well, hey, don't make me lay awake at night. I appreciate the story, though, but maybe there's something about telling things in public. Maybe we'll be okay, both of us.
Well, I don't know.
Have you had any threats recently? I know you have.
No, I used to get death threats. I haven't had any recently. Maybe get some now.
Well, okay, you heard it from Wendell Stevens. We'll keep an eye open. We'll be reading the papers.
Yeah.
Good luck, Wendell.
Okay,
thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jerry.
It's Jerry Pippin. We're broadcasting from the Ozark Conference. I'll be back in a minute.
The Elvis Presley story. The collector's item thought to be extinct until recently.
Now, all 13 hours of this famous worldwide radio broadcast series, produced in the 70s by rock and roll legend Ron Jacobs from Watermark Productions and heard around the world and hosted by Wink Martindale, is now available on CD. Hear the complete story, from the cradle to the grave, Elvis Presley. He was truly the king of rock and roll. The Elvis Presley Story is a collector's item with all of the music and the people who made Elvis the king of rock and roll. Order now. Limited time discount price, $39.95 plus $5.95 shipping. Don't miss the Elvis Presley Story, available to you exclusively through this radio offer. Order now the Elvis Presley Story. Hurry, supply is limited.
Jerry Pippin, and of course we're here at the Ozark UFO Conference. 20th anniversary, as a matter of fact, here at the end of the Ozarks. It's a great conference, always is. Adam Johnson, how are you?
Hey, I'm really good. How are you? Good.
So you do a little work with Ted Phillips, huh?
Yeah, we're actually part of the Special Investigations Unit. We're out of Missouri, and we're investigating... various sites throughout Missouri, and one in particular known as the Marley Woods.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. I like the name.
Yeah. Well, the Marley Woods has been active for over 40 years. And
First of all, where is the Marley Woods?
Well, it's in...
Where are they?
Yeah. Well, the Marley Woods is in the central United States, and the property owners
Is it close to... Fort Leonard Wood or Jefferson City or what part of Missouri?
Well, that's the thing. The property owners are kind of a...
You don't want to tell me.
Yeah.
Okay, I got you. I'm a little slow. But it's in the central part of the state, probably.
Yeah. And, for over 40 years, there's been, sightings of these light balls that have been, just actively inserting themselves into this area. And what we've done is...
So are we talking about balls of light like the traditional orbs we hear about? Or
no. See, that's the thing is you usually hear about orbs, but
yeah. What
we like to consider orbs that most people think of is the kinds that you get on, digital camera,
sure,
which is kind of like dust or some sort of particles. But the ones that we are seeing are typically between the size of a baseball and a beach ball size, so... And they're all white, and in other instances, are they
bright? Or
yeah, they're definitely bright, but not so bright to where they're gonna make you squint or anything. They're like self-illuminated, and it's very weird when you see one of these.
Now, there's more than one of these here in the Marley Woods.
Oh yeah, in one instance, there's a case that Ted's talked about numerous times where. And then this is where he's actually been out there and seen something where they've been out there and, they see one of these little white balls come on and within minutes, they start seeing 20. And even in one instance, I guess they've had up even close to 100 at one time.
Are do they fly in clusters or they just hang around or what? How do they behave?
Yeah, I think clusters, that's a good way of kind of putting it. And, but they do, they part away from the cluster at times. And, there's another instance where there were a couple, attorneys actually out of the site and, they were viewing a cluster in the distance and out of this cluster came two of these, balls of light. And as these balls of light approached, one of them made a right angle turn and, went into the, forest, but the other continued and actually went between the two, lawyers, and that's just that shows intelligence. There's earth lights or whatever you want to call them. Something's not going to do that just out of random seed.
Well, there's reports of throughout Arkansas and Oklahoma and Missouri, like the lights up by in Oklahoma past Miami, Oklahoma toward Neosho, Missouri.
Yeah, is it the Joplin spook lights?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So it seems to be rather common to this area.
Yeah.
Ted travels all over the world. What's he think?
Yeah, he thinks, there's definitely some hot spots, it seems like, throughout the state, but not only the state, throughout the entire country and even throughout the world. And like he says, you know, it seems like the common denominator nowadays is that UFOs are no longer, or I should say flying saucers are no longer flying saucers. You know, they've either upgraded or downsized or something, and so the technology's changed, and it's starting to be more of a light phenomenon, kind of like, you know, just light balls instead of actual.
Do these things make noise?
No, completely silent.
Do they ever touch anybody?
Well, in one case, now this is a case where we didn't actually, I guess the property owners did not have, they didn't see any lights per se, but they felt an effect of some sort of unseen force that pushed them down
now,
to the ground.
Have you been out there to the Marley Woods?
Oh, yeah, I've been out there seven or eight times. Yeah, we were out there actually November of last year, and that was the time that we, as an entire group, all of us were able to experience this, and that was November 16th.
So it's not an individual hallucination?
No way. I mean, we have 194 witnesses total of this area, so yeah, it's either a mass hallucination, which isn't occurring because, I mean, we have this on, you know, camera, so.
So what do you make of it yourself personally?
Well, it's really hard to say, you know, where it's from or why they're here, but or what it is in the first place, but it's definitely something that needs to be investigated
further.
Well,
you alluded that it showed some intelligence.
Yeah.
So do you think they're living things, or are they remote-controlled robotic things, or what?
Yeah, I would say that from hearing all the other cases and stuff, I would say it's some sort of maybe a probe, you know, something that's, in my opinion, possibly, you know, just seeking out the area and just maybe gathering data and just basically research, you know. So I think it's just, a remote-controlled craft.
I wonder why they are concentrating. You mentioned this Marley Woods. It got its name. It must be a wooded area with hills. And,
yeah, definitely. It's.
I mean, what are they looking for there?
Yeah, exactly. And at times, these things, you know, it seems like they just wink in and wink out, but we've actually had video footage, and it's on our new DVD, SIU Files, Into the Marley Woods, and you can see mystery
it's
light.
On that link, on that website, right?
Yeah, well, on the website, UFOphysical.com, mm-hmm. You can purchase that DVD, but in the DVD itself, the mystery light, which we saw back in November, it doesn't just blink out. We thought it blinked out, but it actually dives down at least 100 feet within the third of a frame. So, I mean, these things are moving so fast.
Quick.
Yeah,
quick.
I mean, yeah, they're moving fast.
Kind of like the Roswell rod or whatever that moves around and nobody saw it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, yeah, they're very elusive, and we're just trying to
they're
pinpoint.
They're always circular?
Well, at times. Yeah, at times they're oblong, but normally they're tend to be circular.
And no noise.
No noise at all.
And no one's been injured by them.
Well, that's the thing is that the couple that I mentioned was pushed down, and actually one of the guys injured his leg very badly. He was in the hospital for nearly 6 weeks and almost lost his wife.
Was it from hiding from this thing, or did they think the thing did it?
Yeah, well, they think something possibly of that nature may have done this.
Was it what sort of injury?
Well, it was a leg injury, and I believe his leg.
Is there any evidence of radiation, or do you know?
No evidence of radiation at all. But his leg, I believe, struck a tree stump, and that badly injured his leg, caused a blood clot, and like I said, in the hospital for several weeks.
Well, was he trying to get away from it, or did he pick it up and push him toward the tree stump?
No, he was actually just standing there. And, you know, just out of nowhere, this something he felt pressure on the back of both of his shoulders, and he was struck down to the ground by some unseen force, and it happened the same way to his wife.
How did they describe it? As like a force like a punch? Or?
Yeah, basically just like a punch on one side of the shoulder and then right onto the other side of the shoulder.
So, and they're maybe some evidence that if you're too inquisitive or you're where they are, they may not like it.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, it sounds, you know,
I
that's...
mean, have you felt any fear out there in the woods investigating?
Well, with the fact that they actually have a mountain lion out there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's actually a mountain lion out in this area, and so that's a little, I guess, alarming going out there with unarmed, you know. So I would say that's probably the only fear I've had of anything is
Have you ever had a traditional UFO sighting?
No, I would say this is basically the only thing I've had. My father, back in the mid-70s, he's always told our family about a traditional saucer sighting that he had close up, close range, I'd say a few hundred feet actually above his car in, you know, the middle of the night. And that's, you know, that's pretty typical over the years. So
how did you meet Ted Phillips?
Well, being involved with MUFON, I actually met Ted at the International MUFON Symposium back in, I believe, 2006.
You're talking about the Missouri MUFON?
Yeah. Well, actually, the Mutual UFO Network, just their international symposium.
Okay.
And
in Denver at that time.
Yeah. And through Missouri MUFON, Bruce Whitteman, he introduced us. And, yeah, me and Ted, we've hit it off. And, yeah, we've become great friends. And we couldn't be happier with the team we have.
Yeah. Ted's had some interesting adventures for sure.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, we just got back from Aztec, New Mexico, and there we revisited the Socorro UFO landing site, and we also visited the alleged Aztec crash site. So,
tell me a little bit about what you saw out there. I mean, it's pretty much out in the middle of nowhere.
Where?
Near Aztec.
Okay, yeah.
At the crash site.
Well, we didn't have any direct, you know, sightings or anything, but getting out there, actually, you know, people like to talk about, you know, this happened, that happened, but they've actually never been anywhere. You know, if they're talking about something, they just kind of armchair research.
Mm-hmm.
And just being out there.
Well, that's the reason I was asking you about.
Yeah, exactly.
Describing the scene.
Yeah, being out there and actually being in the same location where Lonnie Zamora saw the this craft land. You know, you can see that, you know, the view he had, he you could tell that, you know, there's no way this thing was a hot air balloon or some sort of, you know, just technology that is conventional.
It sounds like you've been interested in UFOs all your life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question about that. Ever since just, you know, being a youngster, I've always believed there's life elsewhere. And just, you know, learning about the phenomenon, you know, watching television, reading magazines and books, just, you know, getting
intrigued. What other projects are you guys working on?
Well, one of the main projects that I guess we're collectively working on and always trying to get done is the Project Moonshaft. And Ted,
tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Ted could give you a lot more detail into that, but basically the Moonshaft project is about this subterranean artifact, which was found by a...
Is this the one that makes the vibration or the tone? Or the?
Well, actually, yeah. This thing did... it was... heard making vibrations underneath the limestone in this cave that was found, and it was a black gigantic
monolith type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Just a gigantic artifact of unknown origin. And so we're trying to get back out there. We just need some funding. And of course, that's, you know, always difficult to come across, but we really think we have the location. We're you know, 85% sure.
What, Eastern Europe or someplace?
Yeah, that's in Slovakia.
Uh-huh.
And Ted's been out there twice, and doing it, you know, as a one-man crew, as he's done those past two times, you know, it's much harder. But now, as we have the SIU team, Special Investigations Unit, we really feel, you know, with our collective, you know, minds and talents, that we can really get in there.
How many people in your team?
Five. It's me, Adam Johnson, Ted Phillips, Tom Ferrario, Debbie Ziegelmeyer, and Chuck Sukowski.
All of you Missouri guys?
Well, actually, four of us are Missouri, and one of us is in Colorado Springs, to be exact.
You know, our time is almost up here, but I thought it'd be interesting for our listeners to meet some of the people behind the scenes. We hear about Ted and we hear about other things, but this unit is actually fairly new, right?
Yeah, they actually we got this started January of 07, so we've been over a little bit of a year now, and we got our website, as I said before, www.ufophysical.com, and we update that very frequently, and we actually keep our cases current, and our main goal is to insert ourselves into an active UFO site. So,
well, it sounds like you're well on the road to doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think we'll ever find out the real story behind UFOs?
Well,
I know you're doing your part to try to reveal
it. I sure hope so. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. So, I mean, I think in time. No doubt about it.
Yeah, you mentioned these lights or spheres or whatever we're going to call them is maybe a new technology.
Yeah.
In other words, the ETs are using robotics as well.
Well, possibly. And, you know, I don't want to pigeonhole it and leave it at as ETs, but anything.
It's a supernatural
dimensional
thing.
Whatever. Yeah, exactly. And even parallel universe, you know, it's just whatever this thing is, you know, whatever they've been, whatever they may be now. Yeah, it seems like it's definitely the phenomenon is changing, that's for sure.
Appreciate you stopping by.
Oh, sure. Anytime.
And it's been fun and very interesting. And I have a hunch this special investigation unit's going to do some good.
Oh, well, we definitely hope so. Thank you.
And they can find you on the website again. It's
UFOphysical.com.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And we're out of time. Been a fast hour here in Eureka Springs. Roberta Scott has been our own location producer. Jane Swartley, our production director and web producer. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
The doors are finally open at shopjerrypippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features 3 different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at shopjerrypippin.com.